I would also like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak. I didn't have to travel to be here because I actually work upstairs at McMaster University. So anyway, thanks. So as Nick said, my talk is about high-order corrections to the KdV approximation to waterways. So it's going to have a lot in common with Jerry's talk. So I actually asked him last week if I would be talking about exactly the same thing. And well, there's going to be a lot of similarities, so I'll try to keep that sort of stuff short. This is joint work with my advisor, Gene Wayne, who's at Boston University. So here's my sort of outline. First, I'm going to talk about what is the KdV approximation, which this is a big chunk that's going to be similar to Jerry's talk. I'm going to talk about how it's a good approximation, how it's what's maybe wrong with it, and then I'm going to talk about our sort of techniques to fix that, and then I'm going to show you some pictures of some numerics that we've done. So one thing that's different about our setup from Jerry's setup is that we're going to work in Lagrangian coordinates. Okay, so this is we're going to talk about the 2D water wave problem, just like the one Jerry showed. Only we're not going to have the third dimension. We're just going to take acceleration due to gravity equal to 1, and we're going to take the uniform depth equal to 1, and we're going to parameterize the free surface in this fashion. The free surface is some two-dimensional curve in R2, or I mean one-dimensional curve in R2, and it's got it's parameterized by space, which we're going to call alpha, and time, which is going to be t, and we're going to sort of parameterize in this funny way alpha plus x instead of just x and y. That's just a sort of technical thing, but that's because we sort of want it to look sort of like a graph, so that's why we choose that alpha right there. So the Lagrangian coordinates, what that means is alpha plus x alpha comma y alpha t. This is the position of the particle, which was at that point whenever t was equal to 0. So this is a position of a fluid particle, so whatever that means. So in other words, I'm sort of just chasing around individual particles. It's a sort of complicated way of looking at things, but it's useful for proving theorems, I suppose. All right, so that's sort of our setup. With this situation, the Euler equations become, they look like this. So this looks a fair bit different than the Euler equations that Jerry wrote down, but in effect they're the same equation. This is the this top equation here, this is more or less the boundary conditions. Now it becomes it's no longer a boundary condition, it's just a normal looking sort of PDE now. It's nonlinear and all that sort of thing. The other equation here, dty equals kxy dtx, this equation here, this is all the Laplace's equation. It's sort of like squeezed into this equation. K is the it's got a lot of different names. We always call it just plain old K, but It's among other things, it's the Hilbert transform for the fluid domain, or minus that, and it got a connection with the Dirichlet and Neumann map as well. But I'm not going to talk too much about K in this talk. The thing that you should know about K is that you can basically, due to some work by Walter in the 80s, it's got a really nice expansion, which you can more or less approximate it sort of by derivatives and multiplications and sort of things like that. And this is a lot of where the sort of loss of regularity that Jerry spoke of comes in, is making approximations to this K. The last thing I'll say is K, we write it like this. K is linear here in the dtx, but it's nonlinear in the x and y. Okay? So that's one place where there's some nonlinearity. Okay, I'm also going to talk about just one of Jerry's family of Boussinesq equations. This is because there's a million Boussinesq equations, and whenever we were thinking about waterways, we wanted to do a warm-up problem, so this is our warm-up problem. You're going to think here about theta as being sort of like the amplitude of the water, and this is one of the well-posed versions of the water wave equation. It's got this mixed alpha t derivative out over here at the end. So more or less everything I'm going to say about water waves is also like more or less going to be true about this Boussinesq system here. Like most of the theorems and sort of ideas that I'm going to talk about are going to carry over to this problem here. So. So now I want to get back to just sort of the beginning of Jerry Stock. You have these equations that are sort of hard to deal with, the water wave equation. So like Jerry said, Boussinesq and Courtauld Vaigne-Devries, they were looking for these long wavelength solutions. They had small amplitude. They were maybe unidirectional, and they don't change their shape much. This is, like I said, this is all sort of was said already today. So what we do is we make an ansatz in our problem. And so this is where the scaling is going to get different than we saw earlier. I'm going to look for a solution that's small in amplitude, got a long wavelength. So I'm introducing sort of an artificial parameter epsilon here. It's related to his epsilon. I think his epsilon is r epsilon squared. Yeah, I think it's, but also your, right, that's right. So we have a small amplitude. We have a long wavelength. It's going to move in one direction. That's the alpha minus t. And it's got also a very slow time dependence, epsilon cubed t. All right? Now, sort of being controversial, I'm going to just include one wave that moves to the left, or one wave that moves to the right, one wave that moves to the left. Okay, so if I were doing unidirectional stuff, I would just cover up the v term. But I'm not going to do that. But I just make this on thoughts about sort of the y coordinate. I also am making, I'm not showing it, I'm also making an assumption about the x-coordinate, but I'm not going to show that to you. If you do this and you plug it back into the water wave equation, turn the crank, and do a lot of, you know, abuse of mathematics as much as you would like, you get a pair of KdV equations. Secretly, what you get, so you get one KdV for U and one KdV equation for V. Really what you get is you take d beta of these equations, you add them together, and there's also a 3 d beta UV term that we ignore. So what you really get when you insert this ansatz in is d beta of this equation plus d beta of that equation. I got to tell you what beta is in a second. With this extra cross term, which we ignore. And then we'll show that we can ignore that in a minute. Beta, just for the record, is this is what I'm going to call beta minus. This is what I'm going to call beta plus. I'm going to call this T. All right, so capital T is going to be my long time scale. Beta minus, beta plus are my moving reference range. And then I'm also going to have tau equals epsilon T, just because it's useful for me. Okay? So the point here is that I've got a pair of uncoupled KdV. I'm saying that I can model counterpropagating waves by a sum of two KdV equations, which is a sort of different attitude than what you get when you just go to these Boussinesq models. So it's a sort of different point of view. Right. If you do a formal expansion. That's exactly right. But you can drop that term more or less because if you're thinking about U and V as being like this, you have this product, you can drop the term most of the time, right? Because if these guys are both mostly zero, then their product is mostly zero. And so that's sort of the hope. So what is next? So how good does that approximation work? In 2000, Guido Schneider, who's here today, I believe, and Gene Wayne showed that for small initial data, long wavelength, sufficiently smooth, there's this extra condition of rapid decay, then the solution of the problem, and now the way you have to solve this problem is sort of in these funny variables. You have the amplitude, sort of y, you have the x velocity, x of t, and then you also have this sort of maybe seemingly odd variable minus d alpha x. That's more of a technicality than anything else. If you look at that, then the true solution to the Euler equations minus our approximation. So our approximation here is this is exactly our on thoughts, and we have these, you know, we add the u's and the v's differently for the different variables in the problem. Then we get an error of epsilon to the 7/2. So this theorem looks very much like the ones Jerry was showing us. Here this is just a HS norm. It's S is large once again. We also have this long time scale, which is more or less the same one that Jerry had. In our variables, we have t less than 1 over epsilon cubed. T0 is sort of arbitrary, though it changes the range of epsilons for which this is true. Let's see, what else is there to say about this? What this really tells you is that ignoring this cross term is okay, right? At least at this level. There is this sort of funny thing. Remember, our onset was order epsilon squared, and our error, we would think it should be order epsilon to the fourth, and we're losing a half of a power of epsilon here. That's more or less just from the long wavelength scaling. There's nothing sort of bad about the methods that's hidden in there. That's really just a scaling issue, right? Your L2 norms, you lose a half power of epsilon if you scale that way. Okay, so that's, so the, well, just to quickly say this, Guido Schneider proved a similar result for the Buzanesque equation a few years earlier. Same sort of, hypotheses, more or less the same estimate. He got an epsilon cubed here. It's not terribly difficult to ramp that up to the 7/2 that we saw before. And it's the same exact sort of theorem. So here's the first remark. The KdV equations possess explicit solitary wave solutions. This is what they look like. So formally, this proves that we have solitary waves. It's not true proof, but it's at least formally not too crazy. Here's remarkable. This result tells us more than that just solitary waves exist. It basically says that any initial conditions that you have for the water wave equation, they're going to evolve like the KdV equation. So there's sort of stuff hidden in that theorem that tells you what to do with the initial conditions, what to do with everything. But the point is that more or less any long wavelength, small amplitude stuff is going to behave like these KdV equations. So in other words, you're going to have something that's moving to the right that looks like KdV, something that's moving to the left that looks like KdV, and then they're going to interact linearly, at least to highest order. So that's pretty nice. In particular, KdV has these famous co-propagating solitary wave solutions. You have a big wave following a little wave. Big waves move faster. It catches up. They interact in some weird fashion. And then they leave the interaction, little guy behind, big guy ahead, unchanged. So the point is, because of this theorem and because of that long time scale, we're going to see that sort of behavior. We expect to see that sort of behavior. So that's pretty cool. So that was remarkable. And we have remarkable-esque, which is if you do the same sort of analysis on other sort of nonlinear dispersive systems, you also wind up with KdV equations. The Euler-Poisson model for plasma dynamics is one. The FPU model for atomic interactions is another. So this is what something that people say, and I'm not so certain that this is what this means mathematically, but it says the KdV equation is a normal form for long-wave small amplitude behavior, nonlinear dispersive PDE. That's just a sentence. It doesn't have any mathematical backing, except that sort of the philosophy is similar between normal forms and this KdV stuff. So I've told you a lot about sort of theorems about the KdV approximation, but let's talk about what this approximation predicts, and then let's go looking to see if we actually see these predictions. So as I said before, we are going to see these solitary waves. To see that solitary wave, you take the U equation. We have U and V, so I'm going to just take U equal to the KdV solitary wave. I'm going to set V equal to 0, so I only have unidirectional motion in this case. So I'm going to get some solitary wave with a velocity that has of 1 plus epsilon squared C if you change all your parameters back to Jerry's, this is exactly the Boussinesq velocity that he wrote on his transparency. So this is exactly the same as what he wrote down. Like I said before, we're also going to see a multi-soliton, i.e. overtaking waves, where, for example, I could set U equal to one of those KdV multi-solitons, which are explicitly known, and V equals zero. And then the one that I'm going to sort of talk a lot about is we're going to see a head-on collision of solitary waves. That is where you set both U and V equal to the KdV solitons, you run them together. Now remember, our approximation said that the water wave height looked like epsilon squared U plus V. U is moving to the right, V is moving to the left, and then there's this plus order epsilon, the 7/2 out here. So this prediction says that there's the interaction between the right and left moving waves is purely linear. They just add up. There's no phase shift. There's no discrepancy in amplitude. That video that we saw, which I also have a copy of and was going to show, except that I knew that he was going to show his copy. You don't see that in this approximation. There's no... It is. Repetition is very good, which is something that Walter and I say to each other every day. So the other thing I wanted to say about the KdV approximation, right, which is that the KdV equation is sort of the best model equation you can come by because it's got all this inverse scattering business. So you can solve it explicitly. At least you can do it in principle. So KdV is accurate, it's solvable, it's well posed, it's all this stuff. So it's pretty ideal. Unfortunately, like we saw in the video, there are sort of departures from its prediction. It doesn't have any, it says there's no interaction between left and right moving waves. One thing, like we saw in the video, is that if you collide two waves, the water wave is taller than the height of the incident wave. There's a little discrepancy there. Moreover, that was a large amplitude wave, though, too. I agree. Like you said, the Stokes number for that was probably about 15. So, 15 times too big. Or maybe not too big, but... Anyway, that's a very good remark. There's also... people observe this. Some people observe this and some people don't. It seems like there's a big debate about this. During a head-on collision, there seems to be a phase shift, or at least some people see it. The waves get stuck during the collision. They come together, and they sort of hang out there for a second, and then they leave. Both a little bit behind where they would have been had there been no collision. And so by way of showing that at least somebody did an experiment about this, I'm going to show this sort of famous picture from Tony Maxworthy's paper, which says, so what have we got here? This is time going this way. This axis here is the location of the maximum of the wave. And what he does in this experiment is he bounces it off a wall, which a lot of people say is the same thing as bouncing it against another wave, which that's also another thing that's sort of up for debate. But the point is, he runs this thing in, he collides it off the wall, and it bounces off. And then if there had been no phase shift, it would just go like that. But if we look at this, what he measures, it seems to be, at the same time, X is less than where it would have been had there been no phase shift. So there is some sort of phase shift. Once again, this is for very large waves. Or, I don't want to say very large, but larger waves than normal size waves, maybe not small waves. I mean, that's the best way to say it. This is experimental, yeah. And it's also old. Right? They made these waves by making a tank and then putting a little flipper in the tank, and they went like that and made a little wave. Went down the tank. So it's not the most high-tech sort of experiment that's ever been run. But, all right. There's other sorts of problems with the KdV approximation. One is you often see dispersive waves coming behind things. You saw that in one of Jerry's slides. So I call this sort of unidirectional problems. things that are, they're not related to the interaction of waves, but they're, you know, even in the case of unidirectional motion, KdV is not, you know, the perfect approximation. So you see these dispersive waves. Moreover, if you look at sort of the multi-soliton interaction, this cartoon, what do you see? If you look at the overtaking wave, things look more or less the same before interaction, but then during interaction, the weirdness of these sort of overtaking waves interactions are sort of weird, right? They don't superimpose on top of each other during the interaction. They do something weird. And then the most notable thing about these sort of multi-soliton interactions is that there's a phase shift after the collision, at least for the Euler-Poisson equations, which a group including Dave Sattinger, Dave Nichols, and Maria Hargus have done. The thing is, the KdV approximation seems to get the phase shift incorrect for this sort of overtaking wave collision. So that's something that you want to fix for, too. So the goal of my thesis work was to drive a higher order modulation equations, higher order corrections to the KdV approximation to fix these sorts of problems. And so given the nature of these problems, we're going to pick these equations in a special way. We hope that these equations are simple in form because KdV is pretty simple to write down. We hope that they're explicitly solvable or at least simple to numerically simulate. And we also sort of hope that they're independent of epsilon, right? This is maybe too much to hope for, but maybe not. You'll notice one thing I didn't write down here is we hope that they preserve energy. So Jerry might get me on that later. So to accomplish this, we're going to just add to the KdV. KdV seems to be pretty good, so I don't want to throw away what's good about KdV. I want to keep what's good about KdV and then have maybe something that's better added onto it. So I'm going to take my KdV approximation. I'm just going to add more stuff to it. Right, so I'm going to add. My initial ansatz was basically this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write this plus epsilon to the fourth question mark plus order epsilon to the 11/2. That's what I'm going to do. So what is question mark going to be? Well, to solve for these sort of to solve for these sort of unidirectional problems, I'm just going to add functions that have exactly the same functional form as the KdV approximation. I mean, they're going in the same direction because they're unidirectional, and, well, you know, this just seems like a decent guess, right? So this seems like what you would do if you just had unidirectional motion only, that you would just take the same approximation and add it, same form, and add it back. What about for the interaction term? Well, how are we going to deal with this? Well, it's not going to be in a moving reference frame, that's for sure, because of interaction. Roughly, the interaction time of a collision between these sorts of waves is going to be 1 over epsilon, right? These waves have spatial spread 1 over epsilon. That's part of our ansatz. They're moving towards each other with a velocity that's approximately 1, right? So the time that they're on top of each other is basically going to just be 1 over epsilon, right? So because of that, I'm going to have this time scale, which I wrote this down earlier. I have this, that was tau, remember earlier. That's a time scale order 1 over epsilon, so that's the time of the collision. And then I don't have a moving reference frame. So this is some other function I'd call p of epsilon alpha, epsilon t. So I'm going to plug my new ansatz back into the water wave equation. And for technical reasons, what you do is you put minus x alpha here instead of y. That's not as sort of rewarding an ansatz, but you sort of have to make it that way. All right, so you plug that back into the equation. You turn the cranks of, mathematics, and you find out what p, f, and g solve. P solves a very simple inhomogeneous wave equation. In particular, The inhomogeneity is, well, I erased it. It's exactly that same product that I neglected earlier. It's the product of the left and right moving wave. Okay. And then the other functions f and g, they're going to satisfy sort of inhomogeneous linearized KdV equations, linearized about the KdV approximation. Okay. These inhomogeneous terms, I'm not telling you what they are because they're 5 or 6 lines long, and it's lots of u's and derivatives of u's and v's and derivatives of v's and that sort of thing. But we know what they are. And it's not so bad. It just takes too much time to write down. All right? So what can we say about these equations? What do we know about these equations? Well, one is both of these equations are explicitly solvable by some means. The wave equation is solvable by your first PDE course, just by the method of characteristics. So you just write down a real easy answer for that one. The linearized KdV equation is also solvable by techniques that are sort of related to the inverse scattering thing. Bob Sachs developed this in 1983. It's a pretty unpleasant way to solve an equation, but you could do it. Both of them are easy to numerically simulate, for sure. Moreover, these equations are well-behaved on the time scale that we're interested in. Okay, so basically what this says is that the solutions to the linearized KdV and the inhomogeneous wave equations are bounded above by some constant independent of epsilon over the long time scale. So these equations in their own right are well-behaved. They're not going to do anything too unpleasant to us. So we go ahead and then we spend a lot of pages proving a theorem that is very similar to the Wayne and Schneider results, which says that for hypotheses much like that in their results, the solution to the problem, the true solution to the problem over the same time scale is that we do in fact do better. That if we add our second order correction, that's that one right there. So epsilon to the fourth psi 2, that's our new correction terms. If we add that on, then we improve the order of the approximation by 2 powers of epsilon, which is what we'd hope to do. So at the lowest order, the KdV approximation for these three different variables, they're all either u plus v or u minus v or something like that. Unfortunately, that's not the relationship's not quite as simple at higher order. So for the minus x alpha one, it's just f1 to the fourth f plus g plus b. But for maybe the y term, it's going to be f1 to the fourth psi y is going to look like f1 to the fourth psi d plus something that looks like this. Like that, which is, if you recall, there was a slide where Jerry wrote down something very similar to this. Yeah. For this way? Yeah, it's 1 over epsilon. Yeah. Yeah, this time scale is much longer than just the head-on interaction. That's part of I should have made a bigger deal about this. That's one of the good things, is that this time scale is long enough to observe all sorts of different behavior. It's the same time scale as in the Boussinesq models that Jerry was speaking of. Yeah, you have, and also I should point out, there's this T0 in here that you get to pick, and of course that puts certain restrictions on maybe a couple of other things, but you get to pick that T0, so you can pick T0 very large, so you really have a lot of liberty in yeah, that's right. The constant, yeah. There's a lot of problems with that T0, but this constant here, C is C of T0. So. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it seems like to do that, T0 would only have to be about 5. I did this at some point, and it's not a terribly big T0, but like Jerry said, the bigger you make T0, the worse that constant gets, and it's not. That's right. Things get complicated. We have a similar theorem for the Boussinesq equation. So this says exactly what the last slide said, only now for the Boussinesq system. It's the F, G, and P. They're the same exact equations that I showed you before, as it turns out. Maybe some of the coefficients change, but morally they're the same equations. So the reason I spent all this time talking about these higher order corrections of the Boussinesq equation is because actually the numerics of the Boussinesq equation. I haven't done them for Euler yet. Or I haven't had somebody do them for me for Euler yet. Okay, so we have all this analytic evidence that these approximations are good over long time scales. Let's just look qualitatively, see if we see what's going to go on, if we do any better. So the first experiment we do is a head-on collision. This wave and that wave are going to move towards each other once I turn on time. This is for the Boussinesq equation. This axis is theta. This is alpha. I called it x when I did these numerics. So these guys are going to run together, and this is when they collide. You can't really see anything in this picture because, you know, the scale's too far out, but you can sort of see some stuff going on over here, and maybe there's some fishy business going on up there. So on the next slide, I'm going to zoom in on all that and see what happens. So the first thing is that we see is that this is the peak of the interaction. This is whenever they're right on top of each other. And so what do we see? Well, the KdV approximation is seeming to overshoot what the Boussinesq problem does. So this is first of all, with this Boussinesq system, the discrepancy in the amplitude during the collision goes the other way. That's just a weird result about this particular Boussinesq system. This isn't, I apologize. I picked the wrong Boussinesq system, but okay. It goes down. It's less than the incident amplitudes for the theta equation. So the KdV approximation, that's the linear superposition, overshoots. Boussinesq is right there, and our second order correction is visibly much closer. I'm going to draw a back slide. Over here on the right, that's sort of like the dispersive wave that I was describing. So now I zoom in on that, and the KdV approximation doesn't have a dispersive wave. The Boussinesq equation does. And then I add my second order correction on, and we're catching it pretty closely. Looks pretty good. At least the very first lobe of this oscillation looks right on. As we go out here, it gets worse and worse, but, you know, that's okay. So for this sort of numerical experiment, we vary epsilon. We plot the maximum L2 error during this interaction, because we want to get an idea if that power of epsilon to the 11 halves good. Could it be made better? So we do that, and for the KdV approximation, it should be 7 halves, and we get about 7 halves. And for our approximation, it should be about 5.5, and that's what we get here. So this numerical evidence indicates that power of epsilon is probably sharp. We also did this experiment where we had an overtaking wave. So I've sort of cut it off. Here's the big wave that's behind. It's moving that way with a big velocity. Here's the small wave, which I've sort of cut off. It's moving that way more slowly. This is at the collision right here. And you can see that just visibly, the Boussinesq equation is this sort of bottom line. The KdV, during this interaction, both of these systems look nonlinear, but the KdV just is qualitatively not picking up what it looks like right, whereas when we add in our terms, things look much tighter. After the collision, things are sort of interesting. It's sort of hard to... you have to kind of squint at this thing a lot. So the back wave, you can't see any difference between the various approximations. The front wave, Boussinesq is this low one that's in the back. It's this one right here. You can see this problem with the phase shift. The KDZ soliton has shot ahead a little bit during this interaction, whereas our second order correction hasn't shot ahead, but it has overshot. So that's a problem with the energy conservation thing that I didn't include on my list, because this equation, these linearized KDZ equations, sort of grow with time. And that's a problem. It's a drawback. All right. So how much time have I got?
About 7 minutes.
Okay. So here's my slide where I ask myself a question. Where are these pictures for the full water wave problem? We don't have them yet. We're working on it. But let me tell you what I do have. One of the problems with doing that isn't just that solving Euler numerically is less challenging than it once was, but it still takes some time. Another problem is that we have this Eulerian versus Lagrangian coordinates problem. Okay? So I want to talk a little bit about this. This whole time I've been talking about y as if it were the wave amplitude, and that's sort of right, but it's also sort of not right. If we set up the problem as Jerry did, where we have in lab coordinates, the surface is a graph over just my meter stick, right? C here in this picture is just more or less distance down the tank, right? That in the lab. My free surface is going to be a function of that. That's a graph over that and a function of time as well. So these are different coordinates. So you want to compare. We have an approximation theorem in the one coordinates, and we want to just undo the change of coordinates and see what goes on. So if you look at this, okay, x tilde is just alpha plus x. That's what I talked about at the beginning. So if we just compare these two, what are we going to have? We're going to have c is going to be alpha plus x alpha of t. And eta is just going to be y. Eta of c is going to be y of alpha of t. So we want to undo this change of variable. So let's start doing some bad math. Everything that you see on the next several slides is very formal, but you can ramp it up and make it mathematically rigorous. X alpha, just by the fundamental theorem of calculus, is the integral from 0 to alpha of d alpha x. Right? We have an approximation for d alpha of x. It's just epsilon squared, the KdV approximation plus sort of higher order stuff. So if I do this integral, right, I have an epsilon squared here, but I have an epsilon alpha on the inside here. So if I do this integral, I get, formally, I pick up from u sub 1 over epsilon. So x alpha is sort of formally order epsilon. So alpha is c plus order epsilon. So what am I going to do? Well, I'm just going to junk it. I'm just going to say that they're the same. I'm going to say alpha and c are the same variable. So eta of c and t is y of alpha t. Y is approximated by epsilon, my KdV approximation, plus higher order stuff. I'm going to say that epsilon alpha is epsilon c plus higher order stuff. And then I do Taylor's theorem in this last step here. When you do that, unfortunately, you use a half a power epsilon. That's a problem. Okay, that's not so nice. Yes, that's right. This is the reason you get this is because these functions are L1. Yeah. Yeah, that's I think sort of hidden in here why you lose this half power.
Yeah.
No. Okay. I see what you're asking. Yeah, that's right. But these are, like I said, these are rapidly decaying. Right. Right. That's no. You're exactly right. And that's like I said, that's hidden in here, and that's also because, like I said, we have to assume some sort of rapid decay here. So this is less than the epsilon times the L1 norm of my approximation functions. Right? If I let alpha go to infinity. Okay, so the problem is if I go to my higher order corrections, this trick is gonna cost me, right? I'm just gonna do the same thing, but now I'm gonna introduce my second order correction, epsilon to the fourth psi sub y. And if I make the same change from variance from alpha to c, well, I do Taylor's theorem on this, and the error is still order epsilon cubed. So I lose my extra approximability here. I lose my correction in this change of variable. So I need to make a better choice of my change of variables. So, well, that's not so bad. So now this is the same slide I showed before, basically. C was in actual fact alpha plus x alpha, and now I do the same trick with the integration before. But now what I'm going to do, before basically I just junked this term, but now I'm going to call it epsilon chi, right? So just, like I said, this is just formally. So C is alpha plus epsilon chi plus something even smaller. So I just do my 1D inverse function theorem approximation, and I come up with that alpha is basically C minus epsilon chi. That's the cheesiest approximation that you can use, but we are going to use it. So the point is, I know what chi is, right? I mean, chi is given by my KdV function, so it's something that I know. So I put that in. And I do the same thing. I'm going to use my boring alpha is chi expression in my higher order corrections, but I'm going to fix up my KdV approximation with this epsilon squared chi. And when I do that, I find that my surface elevation is given by my KdV approximation plus my new approximation plus higher order stuff. So I do better in the Eulerian coordinates as well. The point that I want to say about this is that this is where I get back to the phase shift in the head-on collision. The thing that you see, whenever we did this, I when we were working on the stuff, I just did this just to make it work. I mean, it was. But if you think about it for a second, this is a phase shift, right? I mean, this is some sort of phase shift thing here. This is encoding some sort of phase shift or phase information. And so the hope is, this is our hope right now, we haven't really gotten that far. Our hope is that we can pick up some sort of phase shift between head-on collision based on what happens in here, right? So really what we're thinking is that in the Lagrangian framework, maybe there isn't much of a phase shift, but maybe whenever we do this change of variables that we pick it up. And so I think that that's where I'll leave it today.